it's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, President Trump's White House staff has seen resignations, firings, and longstanding vacancies. Is this a sign of instability and chaos, or is the president still trying to create his dream team? We'll talk to a political expert about the changes. First, in response to a $4.5 million deficit over the next 2 years, UW-Stevens Point is proposing to cut 13 majors, most in the liberal arts. Programs that could be eliminated include English, history, philosophy, art, and political science. Meanwhile, the university hopes to expand programs in what it calls areas with high-demand career paths, things like computer information systems, finance, and chemical engineering. UW-Superior made similar cuts last year, also in the face of a budget shortfall. The moves are raising questions about the place of the liberal arts at public universities and whether colleges have an obligation to provide students with clear prospects in the job market. Eric Kelderman is a senior reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education. Eric, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. Great to be with you, Rob.
Well, I want to talk to you about how this all fits into national trends. First of all, are we seeing a lot of state schools dealing with budget crunches as we saw at UW-Stevens Point and UW-Superior?
Well, ever since the Great Recession, we've seen a general, shrinking of state appropriations for public higher education. As the recession began, enrollments jumped up enormously in a lot of places, and state budgets took big hits as tax revenues went down. And so the trend of tight state tax appropriations is a nationwide one, with a few exceptions. And it's exacerbated in places like, the Midwest and New England, where you have falling enrollments now with the long-term demographic trends.
And then the other trend we're watching here is this question over, should we have lots of liberal arts options in every public school, or should we have more direct career path education? Is this something you're seeing elsewhere in the country, too?
Yes, this is definitely, as schools, these public regional, we call them comprehensive institutions, think about focusing their resources, there's definitely a tension over what do we keep, what do we get rid of, and a lot of the money goes to places, to programs that are seeing either stable enrollment or growth in enrollment, rather than areas like, let's say, foreign languages or philosophy, where, you see many fewer students interested in those kinds of programs. And there's also the political pressure right now where you have lawmakers saying, look, higher ed needs to be focused much more on creating the workforce of the future. And that's a long-term, that's a long-term tension in American higher ed as well. If you look historically, a lot of the land-grant institutions, were founded with the idea of giving, sort of the average citizen practical knowledge to build their lives around.
Are there philosophical questions that people are still arguing about over, is a university without, say, an English program or some of these other liberal arts majors, social sciences, humanities, is it still a university or is it something else?
Well, that's a great question. I think one important point to make here is that because you're getting rid of the English department, and I think that would be exceptional, but say you're getting rid of a philosophy department, right? That doesn't mean there aren't going to be any courses in philosophy at the university. A lot of the faculty members that teach in these departments will probably end up staying at the university for the foreseeable future, and they'll be teaching courses in those areas as part of the university's sort of general ed curriculum and things like that. Now, I guess the debate is, are you advancing knowledge? Are you creating knowledge and advancing it if you don't have a full sort of robust department in that area? And that I think is a long-term discussion as well about, what's the role of, say, a University of Wisconsin at Madison versus Stevens Point. You have a research university at Madison, a full, big institution where, their focus is on, doing more research. And then you have places like Stevens Point where traditionally the focus has been on, serving the region, more of the students within an hour or two of the campus. And and supporting the economy of the immediate region.
Talking to Eric Kelderman from the Chronicle of Higher Education, looking at program cuts at a couple of UW System schools, cuts on the way at UW-Superior and programs and proposed at UW-Stevens Point, and the role of the university. Eric, Wisconsin has this statewide system. Not every state has something like that, but some do. Do you see the idea of more division of labor in other states with statewide systems? Does every school need an English program, or can some specialize in that? Can some have particular specialties like UW-Stevens Point and natural resources? We don't all need to cover every angle if we're a system.
That's a really great point, actually, Rob. There are other states. I'll look at, for instance, the Pennsylvania system of state higher education. They have 14 universities, and they've gone through a similar process of looking at sort of system-wide what kind of programs they offer. And in some cases, as I mentioned, foreign languages, right? Not every campus needs a Russian language program, right? So maybe you have that hosted at one campus and you offer those courses online to the other schools in the system. So that sort of thing could be accomplished, I think, in some cases as well, yeah.
And we're seeing a wider reorganization here. You've written about the thing where we're going to take two-year schools here in Wisconsin and pair them up with a four-year campus and kind of merge them together. Are we seeing rethinking of the way schools organize their resources around the country?
I think that, you know, the University of Wisconsin system, the merger between the two-year colleges and the university system, that's very interesting, actually, and I think that's one of the most far-reaching proposals we've seen for something like that. So I'm not sure there's a great comparison. But as I mentioned, I think the budget, you know, constraints in a lot of states are making people think about where do we put the money that so it can be most effective, and how do we there's always going to be limited resources, right? There's never going to be all the money that we want to do, all the things that we want to do with it. So and in these times when we aren't seeing, you know, really big growth in state revenue gains, then that pressure is going to be exacerbated, and folks really have to think about you know, the best use of those dollars.
Staying with the funding side of things, you recently wrote about uncertainty in terms of federal funding for universities. What's the story you're watching there?
Well, you know, I think one thing to watch definitely in the next couple of years is the effect of the federal tax changes on the state appropriations. So if you're changing, you know, levels for adjusted gross income at the federal level, how does that affect how much money your state gets in tax dollars through state revenues? And that could have downward pressure as well if, for instance, all of a sudden you're not collecting all the tax dollars you used to. That's another pressure to add to the higher education budget. I think long term, we also have to think about, you know, as the federal budget declines, what happens to federal student aid dollars, Pell grants for low income students, and the amount of authorization for, say, federal student loans, things like that.
Talking to Eric Kelderman. He's a senior reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education. We're talking about proposed cuts to liberal arts majors at UW-Stevens Point and the move toward more career-focused majors in schools around the country. Also cuts to programs at UW-Superior. Want to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the idea of some schools around the UW system getting rid of some majors like history or philosophy or English, replacing them maybe with more technical or science-based programs that come with a more obvious career path? Do you worry about shifting away from the liberal arts? What is the purpose, do you think, of public universities in the country here in Wisconsin? And what is the importance of your local campus if you live in an area around Stevens Point or Superior or UW-Green Bay, you name it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. Right now, we continue our conversation with Eric Kelderman from the Chronicle of Higher Education, looking at cuts to liberal arts programs by four-year universities in favor of majors with more popular career paths. This proposed at UW-Stevens Point, cutting some majors there, some of the more liberal arts majors, getting more technical and scientific majors. Also, UW-Superior cutting a bunch of programs last year. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What do you think? Should all UW system schools be as full service as possible? Should liberal arts play a strong role there? Or should they be more job and career focused for their students? Are you a student or a part of the community at one of our UW system schools? What do you see happening where you are? What do you want to see happening? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. To your calls now. Tom is with us in Madison. Tom, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I'm somebody who went to college many, many years ago. And I pursued things because I was interested in them academically, and I also pursued things towards a job. And I'm just a little bit more than worried about this trend, especially by the current administration and some of the legislators, of turning the UW into a glorified trade school. Now, I worked in the trades myself, so I don't denigrate that. But the idea of Robin Voss and these other people actually tried to go after the Wisconsin ideal, and turn it into a very watered-down version of that. And I think it's short-sighted to play down academics in favor of short-term job filling.
Tom, thanks for calling. Eric, what do you think?
Well, I think the caller makes a good point in terms of, employers in the region often say, or employers nationwide often point to specific skills they want, but often when polled, they also want what are so-called soft skills, right? So they want students who graduate from college with the ability to think independently, to think analytically, to be good communicators, and to work well in projects. These are things that, generally we think of as attributable to liberal arts education, to think more broadly and analytically. And so I think, while employers, often point to specific skills they want, they also want workers who can think in most cases. And that's, I think, the trend line in most jobs that we see is, you need a college education in a lot of cases, and it needs to be something that'll get you beyond sort of the basic skills that you might need for your job today. You might need very new skills in 5 years.
Thanks for your call. We'll go next to Wayne, calling from the San Francisco Bay Area. Wayne, hi.
Yeah, hi there. I wanted to catapult from the previous remarks that were made. I'm a University of Wisconsin Eau Claire graduate with both applied and more liberal arts degrees, including two doctorates. And the applied degrees have been, of course, very useful to pursue my career goals. However, it has been the less applied, more liberal arts exposures that I had along the way that allowed me to, in fact, hone my critical thinking skills, to enhance my creativity, and ultimately that's led to a career on an international level. I founded an organization that works in Africa and several other places on the globe in environmental disciplines. We actually create environmental leadership capacity in developing countries. And all I can say is that limiting the focus of education to technology, to the applied career-oriented disciplines, ultimately will work to our disfavor because we need creativity. We need people that can think. And so I would like to strongly endorse liberal arts education. I think it's extremely important.
Wayne, thanks for the call. And Eric, that kind of bounced off what you just said there. As you said earlier, though, even if you're getting rid of those liberal arts majors, it doesn't mean that the people taking those science classes, maybe the computer classes or whatever, aren't taking the English classes along the way.
That's right. I mean, most of the majors, most of the folks at UW-Stevens Point are not English majors to begin with, right? But they're going to have some writing course along the way. They're going to have some English requirement probably in their general ed requirements. So they'll still be exposed to some of those things. The question is, you know, I guess, as you mentioned earlier, the question is it really a university if you don't have those programs? And that's an ongoing dialogue, right, in terms of what do we really need to have an institution of higher education.
Thanks for the call, Wayne, at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Eric Kelderman from the Chronicle of Higher Education, looking at the role of universities in general, universities in Wisconsin, and changes to maybe the mission, refocusing from liberal arts to more career paths. Back to your calls now. Dan is with us in La Crosse. Dan, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Dan?
Well, I guess more of a question than a comment for your guest here. I'm a graduate of UW Stevens Point, and as I was listening to this, I kind of was concerned that if a university loses some of its diversity in its curriculum, does that have any impact on its accreditation as a university? I would like to hear what your guest has to say about that.
Dan, thanks for the call. Eric, is there an official accreditation of what constitutes a university, and does that end up being at risk if programs get cut?
Well, yeah. I mean, all the universities in the state are accredited what's called regionally, and that designation gives them access to federal student aid dollars. And also, you know, the accreditor works to maintain the quality of the education at the institution. I think as the university goes forward, I'm sure they're going to be very cognizant of the accreditor's requirements for general ed curriculum, and I believe all the regional accreditors have such a requirement that students get some sort of broader education through their 4 years. So they're aware of that, and I'm sure they'll be working not to undermine their accreditation, because that has very serious consequences, of course.
Dan, thanks for the call. Go next to Rich with us in Kenosha. Rich, hi.
Hi. Hey, I just wonder why it's worth for the state to own these schools anymore. Aren't they talking about selling Madison off? I mean, could be a moneymaker for the state just to get rid of them if they're going to cut the budgets down to nothing anyway.
Rich, thanks for the call. Eric, there was talk about spinning off UW-Madison into being independent of the system, basically. Could you not selling it exactly, but could you talk about that a little?
I mean, we've seen these proposals pop up in various states where a flagship institution like the University of Wisconsin at Madison wants more autonomy from state regulation, and basically the rhetoric there is, look, the state is not giving us the kind of money that it used to, and so we should not have to bear the cost of the state's regulatory oversight. And so there have been moves to change that balance, and that hasn't worked out in most cases. To some degree, the regulatory scheme has been lessened by in Wisconsin and other places, but privatization in the longer term, in the bigger sense, is really not possible in a sense. I mean, the state probably owns most of the land and the buildings to begin with, and so when you start to think about it that way, then you run into some other sort of practical hurdles that you would have to get over to really fully privatize an institution like that.
Thanks for that call. Go next to Mark with us in Mineral Point. Mark, hi.
Yeah, good afternoon. I just wanted to come back to something that came up a few minutes ago, and that is the question of the sciences in the curriculum. And what I've seen firsthand, I've been a faculty member at one of the four-year campuses, and the very same people who are trying to push these VOTEC-type classes that are not part of the core academic curriculum. The core academic curriculum is philosophy, history, English, and the sciences, and those kinds of classes. They have been gradually eroding the sciences, the natural sciences on these campuses for at least a decade or two. They've been trying to strip away the lab component. They've been trying to reduce the science requirement. And it's generally a process of trying to dumb down the curriculum and basically undermine the sort of intellectual integrity of the institution. And I wanted to add one thing, and that is that if you look at the elite institutions in this country, the ones where people pay $50,000, $60,000, $80,000 a year to attend, they are not at all going in this direction. They are maintaining academic integrity and sticking with the core curriculum and not going off in a grotesque direction.
Mark, thanks for the call. Eric, Mark, seeing outside interference dumbing down the science curriculum as we try to step up on science, and he sees threats to the integrity even in science departments of their independence.
Yeah, I don't know that I can speak to that specifically. I will say this, that this argument came up when the cuts were made at UW-Superior, that the expansion of the curriculum, the availability of courses overwhelms some students. It becomes a distraction, and you take too many credits. That's the more common complaint that we hear about higher education, which is you get into school, and yeah, there are all these fascinating courses, and you want to take them, and instead of graduating, say, with 120 credits, maybe you graduate with 150, right? And it takes you an extra year because you didn't get the required gen ed requirements. You didn't fulfill all your major requirements in time. And so that's the more common issue that I hear talked about, sort of the curriculum.
Eric, as we start to wrap up, on the funding side of things, have you seen any turnarounds, at least in some states around the country, when it comes to funding for higher education?
We have seen modest upticks in funding in many states. There are some exceptions to that. The question is, you know, have the increases kept up with enrollment in those places and inflation, the increasing costs of say healthcare and energy on your campus, right? Those higher ed has to deal with those things just like any other, just like businesses do, private businesses. And so, and are we back to a place where the funding equals what it was before the recession hit in 2008? And in many cases, the answer to that last piece is no. We're still either at or slightly below those levels. And so, you know, it's been a decade already, and we're still not seeing sort of per student funding levels where they were, you know, before the position hit. So it's higher ed has weathered a pretty significant storm over the past decade.
Eric, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thank you.
That's Eric Kelderman from the Chronicle of Higher Education, looking at changes in the UW system when it comes to liberal arts and other majors. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to the Ideas Network. In recent weeks, there have been more high-level resignations from the White House, with top economic advisor Gary Cohn leaving in the last couple of days. Here's what President Trump had to say when asked about staff resignations.
I like conflict. I like having two people with different points of view, and I certainly have that. And then I make a decision. But I like watching it. I like seeing it. And I think it's the best way to go. I like different points of view.
On top of the resignations, the Russia investigation is moving forward. Pornographic actress Stormy Daniels is challenging a restraining order in effect filed by the president's personal lawyer, and an announcement on tariffs caught Republican leaders off guard. In the midst of this flurry of activity, many media outlets are describing a state of chaos in the White House. Elaine Kmark is with us now. She's a senior fellow in the Governance Studies Program and director of the Center for Effective Public Management at the Brookings Institution. Her most recent book is Why Presidents Fail and How They Can Succeed Again. Elaine, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with this staff turnover at the highest levels. Is this just a cosmetic problem, or does this have an impact on how our government is run?
Oh, it's much more than cosmetic. This is a profoundly serious problem for this administration. It's not just in the White House where there's enormous vacancies and lack of talent, but this president has filled hundreds of fewer jobs at this point in his presidency than any other previous president. So what this means is that there are agencies out there without political leadership, and it hurts the president in some ways because he can't, you know, impose his policies. There's no one to do that. But it also hurts the government because urgent problems and, you know, needs for legislation, needs for change, needs for regulations are stopped because the people with the authority are simply not in the jobs. So this is an enormous problem. No other president has ever had this level of chaos and this inept a government.
On those lower-level vacancies, from a libertarian standpoint, some people have said, great, there are fewer bureaucrats to impose unnecessary regulations on the country. Is there an upside there?
That's ridiculous. That's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. There are only about 600 political appointments of significance. These are Senate-confirmed appointments in a government of over 2 million people, if you include the military, we're close to 4 million people. Now, it is those people who are the ones who have the ability to roll back regulations. They're the ability to decide if you're going to cut the payroll and how you're going to cut it, et cetera. In the absence of those people, the status quo reigns. Okay, the reason this is so crazy is that if you're a conservative Republican and you are a libertarian and you want to shrink the size of government, you need people in positions to throw out the fat and keep the lean. And right now, nobody's doing anything. Right now, in agency after agency, we have a Barack Obama's government and we have the status quo.
One of your colleagues at the Brookings Institution did a study of how much turnover there was in high-level jobs. How does the Trump administration compare to other recent presidencies?
Oh, much more turnover. I mean, much, much more turnover, particularly at the White House level. We're seeing an unprecedented amount of turnover. Often in the White House, there will be turnover after the midterm elections. You know, people serve their full 2 years. There's a kind of break point after the midterm elections. And some people who, you know, sometimes it's hard on families. I worked in Bill Clinton's White House. It's hard on families. It's hard. It's a hard job. So you do frequently see turnover. But you don't see this amount of turnover in the first year of a presidency. This is, again, unprecedented.
Talking to Elaine Kamark from the Brookings Institution, author of Why Presidents Fail and How They Can Succeed Again, talking about a high turnover in White House jobs, other signs of what people are calling chaos in the Trump administration. Touching base with your book on why presidents fail, I remember one of your key points was recent presidents have failed in part because they value communication over management. What's your evaluation of the Trump administration on the communication versus management focus?
Well, let's start with the nature of Trump's background as a businessman. He never managed much of anything. He had a small company not in terms of dollars, but in terms of personnel, family-based company. And mostly what he was doing was selling a communication strategy around a brand, which was Trump. So he never had the responsibility of making a large organization with several hundred thousand employees or spread around the world actually work. And modern presidents have fallen into this trap of valuing communications, tweets, Facebook pages, endless numbers of speeches and appearances, over attention to how they actually implement policy. And for a series of presidents, this is actually blown up in their faces. We remember President Obama and the failure of the healthcare websites to work. You know, no amount of tweeting and communicating and giving eloquent speeches was going to get him out of that trouble, and none of it did. We remember President Bush with the failure of the federal government in Hurricane Katrina. Again, there was no amount of talking that was going to overcome the images Americans were seeing that made New Orleans look like a third world country. So the modern presidents have fallen into that trap before Trump. Trump has very little implementation background, and he's almost the extreme example of this problem.
So somebody coming from a background without that management experience would theoretically rely on their immediate staff. So does the turnover in the White House that could potentially have made up for this lack of experience for the president, you see that not happening, it sounds like?
Unfortunately, it's not happening. I mean, there are established ways of doing business in the White House, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican. And they involve, you know, wonky-sounding things like an interagency review. Before you put out an executive order on immigration, it is typical to sit down with people who run the Department of Homeland Security and people who represent the border guards at the crossings, et cetera, and say to them, okay, well, how can we do this? If I want to do this, how do we do it? How can we cause the least chaos, et cetera, right? So there's processes for that. Trump, it didn't surprise anyone when he came in that he thought he could just rule by fiat. What is surprising everyone is that after a year and after seeing one thing after another blow up in his face, he's not understood the value of a more orderly policy process. He continues to tweet policies almost off the top of his head, and then the policy process has to follow along afterwards, which is, by the way, what's happening now with these tariffs that he just, you know, decided to talk about 2 days ago.
Getting back to the staff turnover, I want to give another listen to President Trump in a press conference earlier this week, talking about changes in staffing.
Yeah, there'll be people, I'm not going to be specific, but there'll be people that change. They always change. Sometimes they want to go out and do something else, but they all want to be in the White House. So many people want to come in. I have a choice of anybody. I could take any position in the White House, and I'll have a choice of the 10 top people having to do with that position. Everybody wants to be there. And they love this White House because we have energy like rarely before.
So no problem if people are leaving. Great people are lining up to take these jobs in their place.
That's just nonsense. That's not the case. They can't find people for these jobs. There's two problems going on here. First of all, the usual pool of experienced people for a new president are people who served in the White House of a previous president of that party. So, you know, the most experienced people in the Obama administration came from the Clinton administration. It would be natural for the experienced pool of people to come from the George W. Bush administration for this one. That was the last Republican administration. A lot of those people will not serve in the White House. That's problem number one. Problem number two is this White House is suspicious of people who are close to the Bushes, given the animosity between Trump and Jeb Bush. Trump was pretty rough on Jeb Bush during the campaign. Both former President Bushes have said publicly they did not vote for Trump. They didn't say who they voted for, but they said they did not vote for Trump. So, you know, what's happened is the pool, the natural pool from which you would draw high-level officials, it is a Bush administration pool, and there the president's tendency to make enemies as opposed to make friends is really hurting him. He does not have a big pool of people ready to run into the White House, or put it this way, a big pool of experienced people.
We're talking to Elaine Kmark about staff turnover and other turmoil in the White House. She's a senior fellow in the Governance Studies Program and director of the Center for Effective Public Management at the Brookings Institution. Her most recent book is Why Presidents Fail and How They Can Succeed Again. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the high level of turnover in the White House, high-profile comings and goings? Does it bring new ideas, fresh ideas, or instability? And what do you think of the way that staff and the president have handled big issues, from tariffs to immigration to North Korea? Does it point to getting things done, or is it, as some people are saying, chaos? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 602-642-1234, or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. Elaine Kmark is with us talking about the revolving door of staff turnover at the White House and what it means for the president's ability to lead. Elaine is a senior fellow in the Governance Studies Program and director of the Center for Effective Public Management at the Brookings Institution. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. When you look at the White House, do you see chaos? How do you view all the White House news, the high-profile departures? Do you think President Trump is leading effectively? Do you see things maybe settling down? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Elaine, let's talk about that settling down idea. You've written about other presidents who have gotten off to rough starts, maybe with the wrong staff at the top. How did they right the ship after a year or so?
Well, they did two things. First of all, they did make staff changes. Okay, but secondly, they learned. They learned the routines of policymaking, which can seem really boring, particularly to a businessman who kind of operated a family operation. They learned the routines of policymaking, and they learned the advantages of those routines in two ways. First of all, it alerted them to the political stumbles. And secondly, it kept them from implementation challenges or things that, or to put it more colloquially, it kept them from making mistakes that just blew up in their face. So, you know, the right out of the box, a president usually wants a success. Well, right out of the box, President Trump's immigration order didn't succeed. In fact, what it did succeed in doing was causing massive chaos around the world. It wasn't well thought out. They hadn't talked to people who actually knew a lot about it. People with green cards couldn't get back in the country. I mean, you remember, it was just a mess. So even if you were sympathetic to his policy objectives, the fact is that he's often very ham-handed when it comes to actually making policy, and he doesn't seem to be improving.
Let's bring on a caller now. Tom is with us in Port Wing. Tom, hi.
Hello. I disagree with your guest on this idea that people from previous administrations are the best to fill those positions. We've seen since George Bush Sr. to the Clintons, from the Clintons to the back to the Bushes to the Obamas, all of these people hangers-oners for too long, and I'm glad to see either nobody or somebody different come in. But part of the problem in this country is too many people hanging from one administration to the next, whether they're Democrats or Republicans.
Tom, thanks a lot for the call. And Elaine, I think a reason a lot of people voted for Donald Trump for president was that he was going to do something different and not maybe go to those familiar faces from the Washington establishment.
Well, doing something different is up to the president, and the voters select a mandate to do something different. But saying you're going to do something different and getting something different done are two different things. So President Trump, I mean, take immigration. It's the perfect example. He got elected to get tough on immigration. Has he managed to do that yet? No. Are there experienced Republican operatives who agree with him politically and on the substance? Absolutely. Where are they? They're not in this administration. So you've got this huge problem that it's one thing for the voters to say, yep, we want things to be done differently, for a presidential candidate to do things differently. But when a president comes in and fails continuously, as this president has done, to make what he said he would do into reality, nobody is served by that, including the voters who voted for him. So the argument is not that we should not do things differently. The argument is you need to find people who can help you do those different things in a way that actually gets them done. This administration is filled with novices and bumblers, and they haven't been able to do that.
Tom, thanks for the call. We'll go next to John in Janesville. John, hi.
How are you doing?
Good. What do you think, John?
I think that it's kind of chaos right now, and everything that he said when he was running, he hasn't done. He said he was going to get Wall Street and the big banks and money out of politics. Well, he's done the total opposite, so a lot of people that voted for him aren't really happy with him, and they think it's just chaos now.
John, thanks for the call, and people have pointed toward a lot of people with experience in big Wall Street banks ending up in the administration. Some of them are still there, some of them aren't. Your thoughts on that, Elaine?
Well, that's exactly what I've been talking about. I mean, there are people who, in the Republican Party, from the Tea Party wing of the Republican Party, in fact, who have been quite critical of Wall Street, who have been quite critical of the way the banks and the big banks have run our country, and all the things that they've done that has sort of made us into a Wall Street versus Main Street society. So, in other words, there's a talent pool out there. It's just that this president has so little feel for how to make things happen that he didn't even get the right people in. So basically what he's done on this particular issue is he's put, as they say, the foxes in charge of the hen house.
Thanks for the call. We'll go next to John in Sturgeon Bay. John, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Good program. One thing I've kind of said from the start, and it's just bearing itself, is that I think this goes even a little deeper. I feel like people in I don't know if it's the top 1%. I know that everyone's not like that, but they kind of just operate by their own set of rules. And I think that's kind of what Trump has always done, is he just creates his own set of rules. And if the government or anybody would come down on him, he would just, you know, either just carry on as normal, maybe sue some people. If he gets sued, doesn't matter. If he loses, he loses. And he just operates in his own world. And I think we're just seeing so much conflict because of that. You know, he's never had to answer to anybody. And I think it's just getting to be, pretty ridiculous.
John, thanks for the call. And that gets back to what you're saying, Elaine, about running a, you know, big money but family business versus a highly accountable position like president.
Well, yeah. And look, even talking about the 1%, even a lot of the 1% are accountable. I mean, CEOs have to face a board of directors. They have to face their stockholders. They have to be accountable for their decisions. They regularly get bounced out of their jobs when, you know, the board of directors and the stockholders don't think they're doing so well. So this idea that Trump has and the way he's operated in his business, it's rare even for the 1%, okay? It's an odd way of becoming a grown-up. And oftentimes he acts like he never went through the, you know, accountability lessons the rest of us did. Take high school principals. I mean, you don't have to go to the 1%. You know, if you're the principal of a high school, you're accountable for what happens in that high school, what happens to your students, what happens to your teachers. I mean, in almost any position, it doesn't have to be a big one, people in leadership roles are accountable. And this president doesn't seem to think he is. And then when he is held accountable, per the Constitution, in other words, Congress or the courts say, no, you can't do that, he insults them and, you know, has this kind of, you know, six-year-old fit at them. So it's a very peculiar way, not just for a president to behave, it's a very peculiar way for a grown-up to behave.
Elaine, briefly as we wrap up, any thoughts that the ship can be righted in the next couple of years?
You know, in the first 3 or 4 months, I thought it would be. I thought, oh, they'll sort of straighten it out. The problem is that no one seems to be able to rein in the president's impulsiveness. And I don't, and in fact, in some ways, he seems to be getting more impulsive. Sort of the more he feels he's backed into a corner, the more impulsive he gets. So this is, I don't know where this is heading, but it's not good.
Elaine, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Elaine K. Mark, a senior fellow in the Governance Studies Program and director of the Center for Effective Public Management at the Brookings Institution. Her most recent book is Why Presidents Fail and How They Can Succeed Again. She joined us to talk about some of the recent turbulence in the White House. Still time for you to share your thoughts briefly if you want to join us via Twitter. You can post at Central Time WPR or email us ideas@WPR.org. I don't watch the TV show The Bachelor, but I am seeing it all over the news lately. It's been on the list of the most viewed stories in the Washington Post for a few days now, and now there's a political backlash, too. Dean Kinetter was watching the season that just wrapped up. Dean, what happened that got everyone so hog-biting mad?
Well, let me tell you. The Bachelor for this season, Ari, proposed to Becca, gave her the final rose. However, after a few months of engagement, decided this wasn't for him, changed his mind, and during a 30-minute unedited scene, dumped Becca, and later went back to propose to the runner-up, Lauren.
Right, this was shocking, this, and a lot of people are talking about the ethics of even showing this whole long, painful thing, right?
Yeah, definitely, and he's getting a lot of heat, a lot of hate.
Yeah, so I was, Becca, right, is from our neighboring state of Minnesota. A police department there tweeted that Ari should speed through their town and see what happens. People have put up an anti-Ari billboard there, and one state lawmaker said if he got over 1,000 retweets, he would draft legislation to ban Ari from Minnesota. He got 20,000 retweets.
You can see why.
People wasn't a classy move.
No. And those billboards, one of them said, strong, beautiful woman seeking man with backbone.
Ouch.
Another said, Ari, not okay, just leave.
Wow.
But Becca will be back next season as the Bachelorette.
So they got good publicity for that anyway.
Definitely, yeah.
Thanks, Dean. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.